We're banning unfair charges and credit card fees. Cheaper home batteries from the 1st of July this year. Good day, good reforms.
Which is why today we can say that there's 13 renewable energy projects have been fast-tracked and approved.
It is the most massive exercise in virtue signalling, which will essentially do absolutely nothing for the planet.
Hello and welcome to the Baseload podcast. My name is Ben Beattie, and occasionally I dive into the social media as a tool to test my theories and challenge the crazy arguments around renewables. Sometimes, though, I do it just to observe the declining cognitive abilities of many folks out there. This episode is slightly different to the normal. A more stripped back edition with no goat and just a few comments up front before we'll get straight into my interview with Jared Holland, head of the Page Research Centre. He's a lovely guy and I think you'll enjoy the chat. Our opening clips were pulled from the social media of Chris Bowen and Jacinta Allen. No special reason, just another example of our energy policy emulating a snake eating its own tail. Followed by a little bit of realism from Chris Uhlman. During the week, I wrote this on LinkedIn. If wind farms receive revenue when the spot price is negative, how do consumers benefit? A somewhat simple question on the surface. I accompanied this question with screenshots of the South Australian generation mix showing lots of wind generation and negative wholesale prices. And what a strange question to ask. Why would I do such a thing? Well, dear listeners, let me read you some responses. But first, the context. We always hear the renewables sycophants boasting about how renewables reduce prices, but they are always cagey when it comes to exactly what prices they are referring to. The favourite tactic is to point out short periods of very low wholesale prices and associate that with lower retail prices. Now, of course, very few of us consumers are exposed to wholesale prices, except those on, you know, deals like Amber, and we'll get to that shortly. Here is a prime example of the kind of comments that I get when I ask these basic questions. The response goes, if I was with Amber, then I would benefit from a negative spot price. If they have the tools to manage variable pricing, they can significantly reduce their costs by getting paid to charge their electric vehicle or battery, and then when the price is high, use local storage to avoid buying electricity from the grid. Or you could do what I do and sign up to OVO, which has a business model of exploiting the negative prices. They hedge for when the price is not negative, in the middle of the day periods. They offer their customers free energy from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. So if I can draw from the grid during that time, i.e. turn everything on, Amber makes money and I get to heat hot water, charge the car and my battery for free. Or you could be with a traditional retailer who hedges across the entire day and provides the customer with a risk-free product that costs a lot more. Isn't it great to see capitalism at work? Okay, if you can't see the problem, let me help you out. In response to my question, which is, again, if wind farms get paid when the wholesale price is negative, how do us consumers benefit over here in retail land? And this guy has replied in the following manner. Part 1. Consumers should sign up to wholesale price deals. And consumers can change their lifestyle to suit the actual wholesale market. And consumers can spend money on EVs and batteries. So let's be clear. Somebody still pays for negative wholesale prices. All that churn is over there. And the point of retailers is that us consumers should be largely insulated from that volatility and all that churn. I went to the Amber site and got a quote. Turns out they say the last 30 days of their plan would cost 43% more than the price cap. I checked their site for what happens during wholesale price spikes. They say they have an app with price alerts so you can hurry up and turn stuff off to avoid the high prices. Yay. What a way to live. So the question was, if wind farms still receive revenue, even though wholesale prices are negative, what is the benefit, the payoff for consumers? Well, it's weird, right? Because retailers may be exposed to the wholesale market, or maybe retailers are exposed to power purchase agreements. AGL, Origin, Alinta, Energy Australia, all these large retailers all buy power purchase agreements. And some of that depends on when they engaged into these power purchase agreements with the wind farms, because the older the wind farm, the more likely it is that they receive revenue even when the wholesale market is negative. More recent wind farms, which is still the minority of wind farms, may well have a cutoff so that the retailer does not have to buy wind farm output at, you know, $80, $120 a megawatt hour when the wholesale price is negative. As consumers, how are we to know? The point is that we are, as consumers, on the retail end, most of us listening will be the domestic consumers, we're downstream of all that stuff. So even when the price is negative, someone is paying. And who are the only people who pay? Us. Jared Holland, welcome to the Baseload Podcast.
Ben, thanks for having me, mate.
Now, is it correct to say you're the director of the Page Research Center?
Yeah. So, Page is a think tank predominantly focused on regional and rural Australia. It was set up just over 20 years ago as really to help the National Party develop their policy platform and to both, support the Nats, but also challenge them and hopefully develop some better policy out of that. I guess the best way of thinking of us is if you've heard of like the Menzies Research Centre or, Labor have Chifley. So we get a modest grant from the government every year, which covers some of our office expenses. And then we go from there and try and hold everyone to account.
Excellent. And you spoke at ARC in London, and that must have been quite an event for you. And your speech was largely focused on energy and what it's meant to do. Or did I get them mixed up? Because you had one in Australia as well.
Yeah, I've had a couple of startups with ARC. So before working with Page, I was actually working on the ARC team. So I was sort of one of the founding members. And when we initially set that up, then actually the call up in London was really short notice. We'd commissioned a piece of work, particularly looking at critical mineral supply chains and those dependencies and the logistical dependencies upon different nations. And I'd sort of been in the driver's seat and getting that work up and running. But the author, Doug Stokes, he was initially meant to speak to that on the second day. And Doug, I think, came down with COVID. He was just like deathly, deathly ill. So I think, what do we do? Does anyone know Doug's paper? And I thought, well, I did a fair bit of work on this with him, so maybe I can speak to it. So it was very short notice, but essentially laying out that China had a strategic and logistical monopoly on, particularly on rare earth refinery and critical mineral supply chains. This was set out by Deng Xiaoping in the 90s, that they wanted to be the Saudi Arabia of rare earths and critical minerals, and have you state-backed entities and mercantile sort of market operations in order to secure that. And of course, Australia does some lithium, and there are some other places around the world that do mine some of these minerals. But when it comes to either ownership of the mines overseas or especially the refining, that's where China has that complete monopoly on supply. And around the time we were doing that, I think China just put some embargoes on the US around gallium and some other critical minerals involved in aerospace engineering and some of their defense systems, and a lot of those embargoes are still ongoing. And it's the kind of thing that we don't really hear a lot about in the media, but actually that security piece when it comes to energy policy is absolutely critical. And we've really been asleep at the wheel. And one of the challenges with this is it's one thing to mine the stuff, but the appetite for refining around most countries around the world is pretty low. It's a pretty toxic business. I think Spotlight and Channel 7 did that piece on Indonesia and some of the factories they've got going on there. And essentially the reason China are the only ones who do it is because they're the only ones who really have the appetite for the kind of environmental destruction that it leads to, and poisoning of aquifers and the toxic waste and everything else. So it's not necessarily an easily solvable problem. And rare earths, counterintuitively, are actually quite common. They're all over the place, but it's digging them up and then refining them. That's the real hurdle that the Western world hasn't really got an answer for at the moment.
I think rare refers to the, the concentrations, just like you can say that there's radioactive material in the seawater, but the amount of energy required to extract it and refine it is quite supreme. So do you think China has reached their goal of becoming the Saudi Arabia of the critical minerals industry? It would seem they've become the Saudi Arabia of renewables, exporting renewables to the world.
They definitely have, and that goes beyond just energy production. I mean, I'm not convinced that they would have seen how impactful renewable energy would have been across Western policymaking back in the 90s when Deng Xiaoping was identifying this. But, it goes to all your batteries, it goes to all your EV components. If you've got a smart fridge, a TV. So it really is across the entirety of the manufacturing sector. And they could see that as we advance, that these minerals will become more valuable. But it's not just rare earths. I mean, shipping, getting goods in and out, they completely dominate the market now. And at the same time as Western nations, the US, Australia, have pursued the path of marginal efficiency, we've lost our merchant marine fleet. So at our peak, Australia had over 100 ships in our merchant marine. We've now lost all of them. We have zero ships that are internationally flagged doing any international trips. We've got a couple that go between here and New Zealand, a couple that head down south to Tasmania, but nothing flagged heading international waters. And same thing with the US, they've seen their fleet entirely decimated as well. And the Chinese have stepped up into that, state-owned entities like Costco. And of course, they're right behind all the building of the new ships, all the shipping container construction. Again, they've got a complete monopoly on these kind of logistical supply chains. And this is the challenge: is globalized free market capitalism doesn't seem to be doing too well when competing with a state-based mercantile system.
Yeah, there do appear to be a few challenges out there for the West. Coming back to Australia, and I think when I mentioned your electricity talks, it must have been a bit more recently here in Australia than the London arc. And you had a really good take on energy coming from it as being more valuable than gold because it enables so much more work to be done. Now, you don't seem like a crazy right wing nut job, not like me anyway. You seem quite balanced and sensible. So, how did you come to this position, Jared, where you think that renewables are probably not the answer for us?
So I think initially, I came to renewables quite agnostically. I sort of didn't question too much that you stick them on people's houses, and we have enough land in Australia that why would it be a problem? And so it's sort of in the space, well, you obviously need dense, reliable baseload power and dispatchable power and the ability to control demand and supply. Our grid is so delicate, a slight frequency drop, a slight frequency increase, without that inertia in the system, without that ability to respond, particularly with your generators, the entire thing can collapse. So I was
Spain is a classic modern example of
Spain's
that, right?
A classic example, and I was kind of thought, as long as you've got your base load in the system, you've got your dispatchability, maybe you can have some renewables on the top for peaking. But the deeper down this path I've come to, it's the more concerned I've gotten that actually you're distorting the market, and just because you can make it work as a system does not mean that it's the most valuable allocation of capital. And actually having these periods during the day where the wholesale price craters because you've got a rush of renewable electricity into the system, and then that massively dropping off, that punishes your reliable baseload generators. You can't turn a nuclear reactor on and off. It is extremely expensive and quite damaging to a coal-fired power plant to start popping around different capacity factors. So I'm increasingly of the belief that any renewables in the system are going to distort the market, make electricity more expensive and less reliable. And there isn't the scale of gas that you need and the scale of batteries you would need to get off coal and without introducing nuclear with a renewable back system is astronomical. And you basically have to build a parallel grid where you have, 23 gigawatts or 30 gigawatts worth of renewables, which, with such a low
10 times that
factor, you're probably looking at 100 to guarantee that you can get some juice out at any point during the day. But then you still need that same level of backup in either gas or batteries, because there will be Dunkelflaute when you have 2 weeks where there's no wind, and there will be the middle of winter when actually having a really low capacity factor out of your solar or at night time. And so increasingly, I can't see how any renewables in the grid aren't anything but distortive. And I think people are kind of misled as well, because you put your renewables on top of your house and you think, oh, I'm getting a great rebate back. My power bills are, I pay $20 a month. I've seen some people floating around. My old man's got panels and he likes his discount, but that discount doesn't reflect the actual value of the electricity you put into the grid. You're subsidized by small generator certificates, which means that people who don't have these solar panels, they're the ones paying for your kickback. And again, it's created this distorted market, this distorted community perception that we're producing more value and lowering prices when actually we're making things more expensive. We're just shifting the costs onto someone else.
Yeah, that's a quite a good summary, Jared, for someone who's not a electrical engineer or economist in the electricity system. Do the root causes of the electricity cost rises, you've sort of talked around that, which is I'll paraphrase and say the volatility and unpredictability of wind and solar generators versus the importance and criticality of an electricity system being there 100% of the time, and trying to fill those gaps is what adds all the cost, right? And we can all understand that intuitively. But do people, in your opinion, do you think people understand that the root causes of cost of living and a lot of inflation things can be traced back to energy costs?
No, I don't. And this was why you mentioned my art talk. And the point I was trying to land with the energy is more valuable than gold is that every single input along the value chain, from when it's dug out of the ground to when it's transported to whether it's grown to whether it's packaged, repurposed, manufactured, to then, you know, put in a shop front, brought back home to be consumed, that requires energy, and not just electricity. You're talking about, you know, your liquid fuels and your gas and everything else in between. But the reason that energy has been so transformative is because with energy, we are able to put machines to work, which means that we can multiply and maximize our own labor. And this is why the developed world, the industrial world, is so much more prosperous than places, you know, low energy parts of the world. And there is a very, very close relationship between energy use and GDP and the cost of that energy. And essentially, the more energy you have and the cheaper you have that energy, the more your wealth as a society and a nation grows. And the inverse of that is when you have a price shock to electricity. I think in the US, it's once energy gets a bit more than 8-9% of their GDP and energy costs, you see the economy start to contract in order to readjust it at an equilibrium. And so this is why we've seen living standards drop so significantly. Yes, we've had runaway inflation, but over the last 10 years, we've seen in real terms, electricity costs increase by 60%. And we did some modeling in one of our pieces of work that we did earlier in the year, that essentially, I'm rounding numbers, but a 30% price shock to electricity, you can expect about a 1.5% loss in potential GDP. And so with that 60% price shock, we've lost about 3% of GDP, which is about $81 billion in 2024-25 alone. So it has a real impact on the economy. The other piece of work that was part of this paper was looking at how not all of us feel it equally and at all times. So if you're in the productive parts of the economy, you're a regional business or you're a producer or a manufacturer, then you will see instantly those prices into your business and your operations. And likewise, if you're on the lower end of the income distribution, so if you're some of the lower thresholds, lower percentiles,
single parents,
income,
pensioners, renters, yep.
Exactly, you see a much higher percentage of your household bills and your take-home pay go towards energy, both directly through paying your electricity or your gas bill, but then also indirectly in the cost of goods that has gone up that has been involving some of that. And so one of the reasons we're so distorted is, well, some of the wealthiest suburbs in the country, the employment profile of these places are not in the productive economy. They're either government jobs or lawyers or doctors, and you really see this in the inner cities. So they're not seeing it in their day-to-day business to the same extent. But they're also the least impacted in their household bills because their income is so much higher. Running a fridge pretty much costs the same whether you're a single pensioner or whether you're living in Vaucluse, and so you have a much lower impact of your bill. So I think there's a severe lack of understanding in the community as to how energy, electricity, oil, gas, etc. It's the very lifeblood of a vibrant economy, and so if you make that more expensive, you make life harder for everyone. And actually, we need to have a much more optimistic, I think, approach and understanding and articulating this, because this is not what kids are learning at school. They're learning about climate change, they're learning about how the world's ending, and they're learning about how coal's bad. And that's about, you know, they learn about maybe AC/DC current in year eight. And that's about the extent of their energy IQ and understanding how energy, particularly cheap, reliable energy, has built the modern world.
Yeah, so that's that. There's a graph that several people have put up over the past, and I've referenced it in social media. It's called energy poverty. And as your energy costs sneak into above a certain threshold of your total income, then what you're saying is it's obviously a higher proportion of your total income. And so you obviously pay a lot more attention to it. And what you'll see the anecdotes are that your single parents and your pensioners in the colder climates start getting colder because they can't afford to stay warm. And this is like what you got back to before with the importance of energy and the value of it. If it's such an enabler of productive work, therefore, I would go as far as to say that without the abundance of cheap energy that we have, you wouldn't have time for an environmental movement because everybody would be out farming, laboring, chopping wood, trying to stay alive. And so this is the eternal conundrum that we face, which is that the more leisure time we have, the more stupid ideas we seem to foster.
Well, there's the more stupid ideas, but to give the electorate credit, our elites, our media, our government officials and our bureaucrats have done an absolutely atrocious job at explaining this. And, you know, I can only put it down to cronyism and corporatism. There's been a lot of obfuscation between what is PR spin and the reality of the ground. Like the difference between a nameplate capacity and capacity factor. The amount of press releases I've seen on a solar farm that's, you know, going to produce 200 megawatts and talking about how many
houses
it's got to power 100,000 homes or 200 megawatts but at a 20% capacity factor, you know, you need 5x that to power that. The difference between a megawatt and a megawatt hour, and actually you're not just looking at the value of energy at a fixed point in time, you need to look at the value of energy across time. This is why baseload power, dispatchable power, is so inherently valuable, because you can guarantee you will get that amount of electricity at any time during the day that the generator chooses, as opposed to being reliant upon the market. And this idea that renewables are cheap, that wind and sun is free, but actually all of those transmissions costs, all that, the artificial inertia, the cost of batteries,
The tropes, Jared. They continue. The rain's free too. But I'll tell you what, hydropower is pretty bloody expensive.
Exactly. And I, if you think back to the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, you know, the electorate, it was the philosophy that the electorate was asked to decide on: should we nationalise or should we privatise the assets? We all kind of trusted that the boffins and the engineers, they knew how to generate it as cheap as possible. But it was, what is the kind of governance structures that we want as a country? But now average punters in the street are expected to be, you know, have a PhD in electrical engineering in order to understand some of this stuff. And so that burden that's been placed on us, I really actually think is quite unfair. It's because our energy system has become so heavily politicized. But we can't make an excuse. We just have to do a better job, like what you're doing with your podcast, and actually educating people so we are equipped to make these arguments. And I'm sure it's the same for you. The amount of engineers I speak to who say, we can't say this publicly because most of the work in our industry at the moment is in renewable projects. And actually going out on the record saying, you're talking a lot of sense, or here's been my experience, and the stuff that I'm told off the record that then never makes it into the public is really, really frightening. And that there is a serious chilling effect on speech when you've got these financial incentives, these subsidy schemes, which means that actually, we're not getting the best advice either to our leaders or to the general public.
Yeah, I've been highly critical of the engineering profession. I put one of my great launches into LinkedIn. Before I started writing publicly, I had a LinkedIn and I deleted it because I was just like, I'm sick of the social media stuff. And then eventually, only about a year ago, I dived back into LinkedIn and I put a post up basically saying, you know, it's not ethical to misrepresent what's going on with energy. And I copped a bit of flack for that. But anyway, a lot of people actually reached out and said privately and said, yeah, someone had to say it. I'm like, okay, well, that's encouraging. You know, there are people out there who do know what's going on. And you're right, they're not allowed to speak out. So you mentioned the bureaucracy, and I'm a big fan of trying to hold the bureaucracy to account. I don't think they're doing a very good job. And I'm talking about the energy bureaucracies, which is AMO, the AER, the AEMC, formerly the Energy Security Board. I'd lump the state energy ministers and Chris Bowen into that, but mostly the bureaucracy. You mentioned at the top of the show that you're sort of on the fringes of sort of the National Party and sort of policy thinking and advice to those guys. Is there any thoughts among the people you talk to that the bureaucracy needs a shakeup? Is it doing well in these areas?
Look, there definitely is. I mean, the elephant in the room, it goes without saying, at time of recording, the coalition got absolutely demolished. A month ago, the last election.
The Nats did not.
The Nats did okay. There's an absolute valiant fight in Bendigo, but we lost a senator in New South Wales. We had a defection in the NT. I mean, we've got the same amount of senators as One Nation does now. So, One Nation picked up two senators, and it's hard to prove if you didn't vote for this, you would have voted for this. But the way I've interpreted that is national voters who maybe feel a bit disillusioned with some of the offering that was given have gone to the parties on the fringe, be it One Nation. I know Jared Rennick just missed out in a seat. He pulled nearly 5% of the vote. And of course, Clive and everything else. And a very rough calculation, I was sort of running through the different votes. And you sort of take those, that might, the increase in the minor vote based on the last election, and that's pretty much a senator for the LNP in every state. And then probably, the other 60% that's gone over to Labor in the Senate is another senator as well.
Is the recent argy-bargy over the coalition and the agreement itself for the Libs, is that in my mind, I see it as a kind of a reset and maybe a reawakening of or more of a freedom for some people to speak their minds, and maybe we can get to the bottom of some of this net zero stuff. Is that an accurate way of thinking about it, or am I totally wrong?
So I wouldn't comment on others and their motivations or anything like that. I think this is how I feel and what I would say and what I've been advocating for. And it's the problems that are facing our country are structural and they're existential. And if you're looking at our debt, whether you're looking at our productivity, whether you're looking at our energy reliability, our energy security, whether you're looking at our plummet in living standards, whether you're looking at mass migration, whether you're looking at our security posturing, whether you're looking at our defense capabilities, whether you're looking at our supply chains and our critical industries, whether you're looking at our birth rates and our marriages, and whether you're looking at housing, right?
Like, there's not many positive stories out there, is there?
Our country is absolutely on its knees. And so I realize a lot of this is media beat up, and it's not necessarily the conversations that are happening behind closed doors, but the idea that we need to tack more to the left, or we need to tack more to the right, or we should be harder on this cultural issue or softer on this cultural issue, that we need to save the country, and there's a very clear pathway of things that need to be done. And it will not be possible to deliver lower energy prices and increase productivity as long as we're committed to net zero. It will not be possible to ensure our critical supply chains or industries as long as we're committed to net zero. It will not be possible to arrest the mounting debt without looking at tax reform, without rethinking our approach to royalties and windfall tax, without approaching tax reform. Like, for me, the big issues demand answers. The big issues already have a lot of answers on the shelf. And I would be saying, okay, A, we need to articulate to the general public just how bad things are. And this isn't a time for doing TikTok dances. This is a time for being really, really honest. Because I think things are extremely dire. And then two, articulating our vision for the solutions. And then the part three of that is, okay, we know what the problem is. We know what the solutions are. Now you can get into the game of how do we best communicate that to the electorate? How do we best communicate that to our different demographics? And I think one of the real worry about modern politics, particularly on the centre-right, but the centre-left does it as well, is let's focus test people on what they care about, and then based on what they tell us in a focus group, try and give them a policy around that. And what you get is a hodgepodge of whatever the Guardian or the ABC or the dominant media class has been saying are the most important issues.
It's a parallel universe, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And again, everyone has their own particular important thing. Now, I'm not saying that whatever anyone's individual cross is to carry isn't important, but actually I think in leadership, we need to guide the country through that. And we say, okay, we think, for example, we need to scrap net zero, build super ultra critical at the mine mouth coal-fired power stations in order to get electricity down, for example, right? If people say, I don't like that because it sounds dirty or it doesn't sound like it's good for climate change, well, then use the polling to work out how do we best communicate why we think this is the right idea. You don't use the polling to say, oh, we better scrap that because it'll be unpopular and let's give them something that will actually exacerbate the problem. So I think that's where I would love to see the coalition or any, this is where I want to see Labor go. Like I, you know, Page obviously is particularly concerned about regional issues, but our this is a message for all of Australia. And at the end of the day, Labor's at the reins, and I'm deeply, deeply hopeful that they actually realise, shit, we've kind of backed ourselves into a corner here. We might need to do some stuff that's quite radical, or else we could have a legacy of being the ones that lost Australia and led us to Venezuela or Argentinian style decline.
It'll be radical for Labor, I guess. Not so radical for the older school Labor people, but maybe a bit more radical for the new ones and the Greens and Teals. They would certainly kick and scream. The rest of the world is steering away from net zero commitments, and you talked about that just a second ago. As far as Australia is sort of leaning in, and I would paraphrase you and say we probably need to be at, if not pausing, maybe leaning away from net zero, at least for the time being. And the way I would say it to people is, and to anyone who's listening, like, if I had godlike powers for a day, I would halt all emissions reduction policies and turn them all off. And then I would say, go and argue for a carbon tax, make the argument. I don't think we've had the argument in Australia properly. We just get safeguard mechanism, new vehicle efficiency scheme, renewable energy target. Now we're going to get capacity investment scheme. We've got tens of billions given away to the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, and you've got ARENA in there as well. That's just from the Fed programs. Then you've got all the state programs as well. So we're struggling on what we've been talking about with all the issues. And another thing, a theme, if I can be so bold, that you are getting on is, just get the basics right. I would really like, and across all the policy platforms on the industry sectors, I'd like to do that somewhat myself. But yeah, godlike powers, just shut it all down, make the argument for a carbon tax, because no one's actually done that yet. That's my rant on that. What good ideas are out there, Jared? What have you come across in your travels and talked to people about? Is there anything struck you as good ideas, and maybe leave it to on the energy side, what can be done, and what do we think we should be doing there? What's a good idea that you've heard?
So, well, you know, it's interesting. We just had a large debate in the country around nuclear power, and that was obviously the coalition's plan, and for various reasons they didn't seem to want to. They went to bat in it early and then seemed to back away come the election campaign. Look, I think nuclear is a brilliant idea, and it's for that reason of power density. And it's that, you know, nuclear is the densest commercially available energy source that we have. And so, you know, when you're looking at land use, when you're looking at the impact of mining, when you're looking at all of those different things. Utilizing existing transmission.
And fuel security, sites. Because we mine it here as well.
Exactly. You can keep the rods for years. You can just stick them in a, you know, you could have 50 years of supply just sitting there that you don't have to worry about. Having said that, by the time we get through all the NIMBYism, both through the states, through local council, they obviously have to, the moratorium would have to be overturned. You're then going to have all of the legal warfare. I mean, you look at what's going on in Queensland at the moment, where you can't even open a metallurgical coal mine to make steel. Let alone the kind of community and activist resistance you're going to see. Nuclear is a great policy for our kids to have cheap, abundant electricity. If we want cheap, abundant electricity right now, and we want cheap, abundant electricity for the kind of decade that we're heading into of serious geopolitical uncertainty, then we're going to need coal-fired power stations. There's no way around it. We have tied ourselves in such deep knots between the government investment corporations, between the super funds, between the private capital that has been bought and sold up to these horrible spin campaigns, to the subsidy regimes, that what we would need to do is just cancel our future renewable projects and turn everything off at the switch tomorrow. And there would be an enormous amount of pain, but did economics at uni, and I was always taught the sunk cost fallacy, that just because you've spent a lot of money doesn't mean that it's justified to continue to spend stupid amounts of money. But unfortunately, the sunk cost fallacy doesn't tend to have made its way to public policy. And so the argument that we've spent so much money on the transition and there's already so much money that's been allocated, we can't afford the shock. And look, there's no denying, if you turned it all off tomorrow, you ended the subsidy regimes, a lot of companies would go under. It probably would send Australia into a recession, because we've been such idiots in getting ourselves into this mess in the first place.
Yeah, but we're in a hole.
I think the only serious pathway is to recognize there is going to be economic pain. That is undeniable. We've backed ourselves into a corner, but how quickly do we want to get out of it, and how seriously are we about the kind of Australia that we could have when we get out of it? The thing that makes me really nervous is a lot of industries, they're either 100% or 0%. You know, aluminium smelters can't sort of power themselves just some of the time. Our petrochemical industry and plastics industry can't exist some of the time. It's either we have the infrastructure and resources in order to sustain these industries, or we don't. And I'm deeply concerned that outside of serious government subsidies, which aren't addressing the underlying concerns, we're going to continue to lose our fertilizer industry. We're going to continue to lose our agrochemicals. We're going to continue to lose our last two remaining petroleum refineries. I'm pretty pessimistic about Australia's outlook, industrial outlook over the next couple of years, just because we're so far away from course correcting, let alone acknowledging that we have a problem.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that outlook. I think I've said to people that even if we had the best of intentions and a completely sane government with a mandate, in inverted commas, it's close to a 30-year problem. You can stop the rubbish and the crazy ideas, but you can't actually reach out and take solar panels off people's roofs, even though the rooftop solar, the rampant growth in that has made it the biggest technical and economic problem. We touched on that earlier. You can't go out and turn off the contracts for all the wind and solar farms that exist. It all has to run out its time. So therefore, and it's going to be the taxpayer. I don't see any private company running a coal-fired power station at a loss, exposed to carbon taxes, obvious or not obvious. So I think there is going to be a taxpayer burden. I agree with you that nuclear, there's definitely a future for nuclear. I think arguing for nuclear because of emissions reduction is not the right strategy. I'd rather much argue, like you did, for nuclear on low operational costs. Yes, it's got high capital, but it's also got a long time to amortize that cost over its lifetime, right? The depreciation, etc. But it's there for a long time, and you just make that site, it's a nuclear site forever. You know, a couple of generations of workers, a couple of lifetimes of people, that can really set us up for the future. So we've got a few minutes left. If you had 5 minutes with Chris Bowen, how would you approach a sit down like that, and what would you raise as problems or suggestions?
Oh, gee.
Apart from resign immediately and go and run COP or something.
It's hard to know, and I really set out in this game and not to give people the benefit of the doubt and to not call out people individually. And I'd really love to keep the argument in the place of idea. The problem with Bowen is and with my own self-imposed rule, is I can't tell whether he's incompetent, whether he's naive, or whether he's deceptive. Because you can't tell me that at the position that he is in and for the length of time that he's been in it, he could be this ignorant to the catastrophic challenges that are currently facing our grid. I think the thing, I don't know if this is, you know, Chris Bowen specifically, and I don't think he would really care, but for people who are pro-renewables, I think the message I'd really love to get out there is it's back to that point of power density, and that you protect the environment by not using it. And renewables are not good for the environment. The air, wind, the sun, it is such a diffuse energy source that you need an insane amount of machines, you need an insane amount of raw resources and materials and land use in order to harness that and turn it into electricity. And that's not including all the batteries and the transmission lines and everything else. And I think people have this idea, like policy making is all about trade-offs. There's no such thing as a free lunch, right? Digging a coal mine is dirty. It's dirty work. It's a big hole in the ground. But when you're comparing apples to apples, that coal mine, that seam, that hectare or 2 hectares or 3 hectares, that could power millions upon millions upon millions of homes for generations. And in fact, that's what we do. The vast majority of our coal goes overseas, and it powers the world.
Sure, there's a trade-off, but that trade-off
is a
significant benefits, right?
Exactly, because you've got such a dense source. You're saying, okay, if we're going to have to dig somewhere and use the environment somewhere, we want to be doing it in the densest possible way to provide the biggest possible benefit. Renewables are the opposite equation. You still need all the mining. You still need all the rare earth. You still need all the steel. You need all the cement. You need all the glass. You need everything. You still need all that coal. But on top of that, you're destroying rainforest, you're destroying prime agricultural land, you're destroying coastlines. And so,
and you're doing it every 20 years, 20 to 25 years as well.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I think this is what, you know, makes me so upset is, like, sure, there's a conversation to be had, and I wouldn't subscribe to it, but I understand that, well, maybe having a cleaner environment is a premium that we should put on our industrial world. Right now, I would disagree with that. I'm a big believer that the wealthier we are, the more we steward the environment, all that kind of stuff. But I appreciate there's an argument there. There should be some kind of tax on industry because we want to be cleaning up the world. But we're not. We're not. We're actually doing more destruction to our natural environment. We're doing more destruction to nature. And that's, I think, what's really egregious. So I just want to say, Chris Barnes, if you're doing this to clean up the environment, you're making it worse. And I will happily say that coal is better for the environment than renewables are. but we're not even having that argument as a society. And so that's where I'd love to go with it.
Jared, you're making a lot of sense to me. If you're here, I'd give you a big hug because you just make me feel so good about things. That there's some sensible people in the world. You've been a great guest. Thanks for joining me.
Mate, really appreciate the opportunity to come on. And thank you for everything you're doing as well, because one of the biggest problems is we don't have enough voices actually breaking this stuff down in bite-sized, accessible ways. So, mate, keep up the good fight. And we will win. I just hope we don't go through too much pain before we get there.
More pain needed is the phrase, right? Thanks, Jared.
Thanks, Ben.
You've been listening to the Baseload Podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.